If I am asked, what do you value in human life and why do you value it? I cannot prove that my answer is better than another man's, as I could prove a proposition in mathematics. What I think I can prove is that if men care for and aim at certain essentially very simple things, almost all will be happier and have a fuller life than they will if mankind are led astray by partial and cumbative aims, such as exploitation of other human beings, dominance over supposed inferiors, or victory in violent conflicts. On such grounds, I can defend the belief that love is better than hate, that a society where there is diffused creative initiative is better than one composed of many masters, few masters and many slaves, and that, while what is of most value is to be found in the lives of individuals, the best individuals are those whose thoughts and feelings are linked to those of others, intimately to family and friends, less intimately, but still importantly, to those of all mankind, not only in the present, but also in the past and the future. It is this sense of integration with the life of mankind that gives value to the study of history. Men at first were few. They lived in fear of wild beasts and in constant danger of starvation. They had little leisure for the activities that distinguish man from the brutes. The life of the human species hitherto has been a gradual march out of precarious darkness and misery into the slowly increasing light of knowledge and security against the harsh dominion of niggardly nature. The chief causes of this progress have been technical improvements brought about by human ingenuity. Each great stage in technical advance, however, has brought with it at first great evils which were unnecessary. Agriculture brought human sacrifice, slavery, and absolute monarchy. In our day, science and machine industry has led to such things as the totalitarian state and the atom bomb. A philosophy of life in our day must seek to dissociate science and machine production from such evils, as the liberal thought of the 18th century dissociated agriculture from serfdom and subjection. A philosophy of life in our day must be one adapted to machine industry, not merely to one of the earlier stages of human development. Machine industry has compelled communities to be much more closely knit and much more highly organized than societies of former times. It has made men much more interdependent and has compelled those who value individual liberty to seek fresh interpretations of old doctrines. The power that modern technique gives men over their physical environment has tended to shift the generally established values, giving more emphasis to energy and enterprise and less to humility and endurance. It is easy to carry this change too far, but up to a point it is valuable. Philosophers are fond of producing endless muddles about ultimate ethical values and the bases of morals. My own belief is that so far as politics and practical life are concerned, we can sweep aside all these puzzles and content ourselves with common sense principles which no one in his senses would dispute. We all desire and need food and shelter and clothing. We all desire security from injury, whether at the hands of each other or at the hands of nature. We desire happiness and the joy of life and health, and we desire freedom from constraint insofar as this is compatible with social life. We do not all desire intelligence. I have known people who are perfectly content to have very little of it. But we must all recognize that a modern community cannot prosper unless a considerable amount of intelligence is to be found among its members. On these things, I think we are all agreed. Our disagreements are not as to what it is good to have, but as to who shall have it. This last is not an ethical question, unless we adopt some principle of justice. In the absence of some such principle, the question, who shall enjoy the good things, is a military question. Why are white Americans richer than red Indians? Because they have superior weapons of war. Why was Europe, for several centuries, able to exploit the riches of the East? Because Europe was superior in artillery. It has been a rule hitherto, in every age and in every country, that the powerful were rich and the weak were poor. Sometimes legal systems have preserved traditional wealth for a time without the backing of superior power, but such a state of affairs has always been temporary. Now, owing to the greater interdependence of individuals and nations, The predatory practices which have come down to us from the past are no longer appropriate. A community in which everybody steals from his neighbour instead of doing an honest day's work will soon reach the point where there is nothing left to steal. Internally, civilized nations have long ago realized this fact. But where relations between different nations are concerned, those who mention this fact are still considered paradoxical and unpatriotic. This is entirely due to the fact that tradition outweighs common sense. I spoke a moment ago about food and shelter and security as things we all desire. We seek these things in practice by destroying each other's crops, bombing each other's houses, and killing each other in vast battles, which is absurd, as the geometers would say. This lack of common sense may cause a cynic to smile, but it will cause a lover of mankind to weep. We have at last, through science and scientific technique, emancipated ourselves to a certain degree from bondage to nature. If we were wise, we could now extract necessities and moderate comforts without excessive labour. But for our own evil passions, we could build a society of human beings who would be happy and free and creative. The good individual, as I conceive him, is one who is free to develop and grow, who, because he is free, is not envious and restrictive of others. His happiness is dynamic, not static. It lies in what he is achieving, not in what he passively enjoys. Owing to his creative freedom, he has outgoing emotions of generosity and kindliness and affection, not the morbid, thwarted malevolence of the man whose powers are allowed no scope. There is an intimate relation between the excellencies of a society and the excellencies of the individual. A good society is one that makes the existence of a good individual easy. It should give education in initiative and self-reliance. It should give both security and the opportunity for adventure. It should contain no poverty, no war, no slavery, whether physical or mental. It should be able to permit much freedom because the individuals composing it would find adequate scope in cooperative activities and in artistic or intellectual creation. I do not mean that there will no longer be need to restrain criminals. I mean that there will be so much scope for activities that are not criminal that few men will be tempted into crime. The world having all these excellencies has become technically possible. Nothing stands in its way except the evil passions of human beings, especially envy and hate and fear. Our very emancipation from slavery to nature has given to our evil passions a new scope and a new destructiveness. Never in human history has there been so great a possibility of good as at the present day, and never has there been so great a likelihood of appalling evil. This makes ours a very difficult time in which to live, and makes certain demands upon us, both individually and nationally, which in easier times would not be made. In dangerous times, such as those in which we are living, certain virtues become difficult, but in proportion as they are difficult, they are important. If our existence is to be useful rather than harmful, we must learn truthfulness in our thinking. This is difficult because much truth is painful and because intellectual honesty makes it impossible to accept any easy nostrum. It is difficult also because it makes it almost impossible to be a wholehearted adherent of any party. There is a cozy warmth in being one of a herd who are all of one mind, and their unanimity quiets our own doubts. But if you think for yourself, you are not likely to discover any large group with whom you can agree about everything, and you will find some degree of mental loneliness unavoidable. What is needed above all is courage. In many situations which occur in many countries at the present time, physical courage of the very highest order is required, moral and mental. But for those of us who are more fortunate, courage is still required, moral and mental courage. We must face the dangers which confront mankind, and we must not let ourselves imagine that there are easy or simple solutions. For example, some people will tell you that all would be well if we all underwent a change of heart. I think this is quite true, but it is not a very useful truth, since we do not know how to bring about such a change of heart. Courage is needed to retain a rational outlook when reason can offer no certainty of a happy outcome. Many people, under the influence of fear, are inclined to relapse into some form of superstition, or to advocate on our side The very same detestable regimentation which leads us to condemn totalitarian regimes, not perceiving that this is to suffer moral defeat before the contest has begun. Meanwhile, we must retain sanity, which is difficult if we brood too much over what is dark and tragic. Whatever may be in store for us and for the world, it is well that our leisure should be spent in enjoying whatever can be enjoyed without injury to others. There are still dewy mornings and summer evenings and the sea and the stars. There are still love and friendship and music and poetry. And when we need some consolation nearer to the stuff of our anxieties, it is always to be found by removing our gaze from the immediate foreground. There have been earlier cataclysms, but the spirit of man has survived. In spite of some alarmists, it is hardly likely that our species will completely exterminate itself. And so long as man continues to exist, we may be pretty sure that whatever he may suffer for a time, and whatever brightness may be eclipsed, he will emerge sooner or later, perhaps strengthened and reinvigorated by a period of mental sleep. The universe is vast, and men are but tiny specks on an insignificant planet. But the more we realize our minuteness and our impotence in the face of cosmic forces, the more astonishing becomes what human beings have achieved. It is to the possible achievements of man that our ultimate loyalty is due. And in that thought, the brief troubles of our unquiet epoch become endurable. Much wisdom remains to be learnt. And if it is only to be learnt through adversity, we must endeavour to endure adversity with what fortitude we can command. But if we can acquire wisdom soon enough, adversity may not be necessary, and the future of man may be happier than any part of his past.